From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 411 of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you are listening to us from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. It is September the 9th, 2012, and we're taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, and our long-distance number, 1-800-580-2372. Looking forward to speaking with you today, encouraging you to call in early, get you on the air right away, and spend some time discussing issues that are of concern to you and likely of concern to many other people as well. As you remember, there was in New York City, Michael Bloomberg wanted to, and I think the vote is coming up this week, to ban the large soft drinks, 64-ounce soft drinks, sort of curtailing and reducing the sizes. I think it was even 32 ounces, which is a lot of soft drinks to drink in one time, as a means of trying to reduce calorie consumption, focusing on soft drinks, at least at the beginning, and maybe other things later on. Well, in California, there are two small California cities that are the latest battleground for a soda tax, a soda tax that is likely going to be fought by the U.S. soda industry. Now, to give you an idea of the size of the U.S. soda industry, so not Canada, just the U.S. alone, and remember, these are international companies, it is $111 billion, so one-tenth of $1 trillion industry on soda alone. And so in November, voters in cash-strapped Richmond and El Monte will decide whether to pass a penny per ounce tax on sugar-sweetened drinks. So remember, you're looking at maybe 10 cents, 12 cents. You know, in the United States, they still go by ounces. So they're usually 12-ounce cans. So it's 12 cents on a can of pop that they want to use to help bolster their municipal coffers because they are cash-strapped. And they also are saying to fight obesity. And as we had with Dr. Yoni Friedhoff and Dan Gardner this summer, we talked about how this is, you know, it's a multi-prong effect. You can't expect this alone to affect the influence on obesity, but multiple approaches from different areas may help in combination reduce the risk of weight gain. So they are in a war now. The American Beverage Association, which represents Pepsi, PepsiCo Incorporated, Coca-Cola Incorporated, Dr. Pepper, Snapple Group Incorporated, and other beverage companies has spent already millions of dollars to beat back soda taxes around the country. And they're about to do that again. And their argument is that the American Beverage Association says that a tax on soda would hurt poor people and local businesses while unfairly targeting one product. Remember, we're talking about one penny per ounce, 10 cents on a can of pop. And cans of pop in the U.S., and as you know, cans of pop here, varies. You go to a vending machine, that's about $1.25, sometimes $2, depending on the size. So it's not a huge proportion of the total cost of a can of pop. And so they've said that they don't think it's going to help affect fighting obesity. And, you know, maybe that's true, maybe that's not, but we don't know because we haven't established policies to really see if all these things can contribute. And to give you an idea of how much, in the United States anyway, how much a person drinks on average per year is 44.6 gallons. Now, a U.S. gallon is 3.76 liters, so it's a little less than our what a Canadian gallon used to be. So, but nevertheless, 45 U.S. gallons per year, which is down from a peak of 54 gallons in 1998. And this is according to Beverage Digest. And they said that diet drinks, water, and teas now account for a bigger portion of sales. And to give you an idea, the teas, though, that are being sold have sugar added to them. So although they're saying it's 44.6 gallons of soda, find out how much iced teas people are consuming and energy drinks and such, which also are carbonated and considered to be more of a soda-type drink. So, and this follows a Tufts University review of studies published over 17 years that found that consumption of soda that contained sugar or sugar-sweetened beverages was the most consistent dietary factor associated with weight gain. And these particular towns, Richmond and El Monte, have the dubious distinction of having some of California's highest proportion of obese and overweight children, with rates above 50%. So they're dealing with a situation very different than what we have in Ottawa, and are trying different ways. I mean, in some ways it's desperation, but they are trying different ways to reduce the consumption of sugary or sugar-sweetened drinks. So my question to you is that, given that you've got an industry that's $111 billion, and frankly, I don't think is going to suffer very much from a soda tax, that their products will be still purchased, and it's taxed on sugar-sweetened stuff, but not on the diet stuff. So there's the other difference as well. What do you think about this? Do you think that these cities are correct in trying to approach this way? Do you think that we should just leave things alone, considering that really what we're talking about is soda? Let's face it, it might be fun to drink and we enjoy drinking it, but it's not imperative for staying alive. Do you think that these cities should be taxing at 1 penny per ounce as a means of increasing their income to try and combat some of the real problems and health problems that they find in their particular and respective towns? So I'd be interested to know whether you find this heavy-handed, nanny state type stuff where you're charging people for drinking something that is a legal product, and that, you know, you're just basically saying, well, we don't want you to drink this too much, so we're going to tax it. But remember, we tax alcohol, tax cigarettes. There's all kinds of taxes out there for the different things that we do. So really, I just am looking for your opinion, given that these particular towns have 50% obesity rates for their children. And yes, granted that there's likely other influences as well. But again, when you drink any kind of drinks that have calories in them, so let's just say it's a soda, you do not have the equivalent effect on your appetite suppression as you would if you ate solid food, real food that had the same amount of calories. So you don't feel very full. So really what you're doing is you're drinking, and it can be whatever amount that you drink, but it will not change how much you normally will consume in terms of solid food. So that's where those extra calories become a problem, is that you eat what you normally eat. You may come into the normal range of calories for what you should have, but then you add on the liquids that have a lot of calories to them, and you end up gaining weight over time. Now, granted, that's a simplification, but it follows the pattern of what we tend to see with people in how and why they gain weight. Typically, someone will come into the office and say, I don't know why I've gained weight. I've all of a sudden seemed to have gained so much. But really, when you take a good history, you find out that there are a lot of sources, soda being one of them, coffees with their sugar and creams being another, some of the snacks that people have. There are other factors, granted, that will contribute to weight gain. But the question is, where do you start? Because we do have evidence that people are getting heavier. Diseases are going up in terms of incidence, diabetes, heart disease, still on the top of the list in terms of what causes us harm, and that's not going away. So I'm curious to know whether this is something you would agree with, and what your solution would be, given that we have food out there that really is not healthy for us. And yes, it's a free society. We can eat that if we want to, but we have a healthcare system that is straining. We have a healthcare system that we cannot afford right now, and only more demand is going to happen. So I'm curious to find out where you stand on this. Do you agree with these two cities? Do you agree with the American Beverage Association? We're going to take a small break and come back. Our lines are almost full. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And we'll be back with your calls in just a couple of minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Doctor, please. Whoa.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And we're going to go straight back to the phone lines. And a good afternoon to Dennis in Metcalf. How are you doing?
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I remember watching a documentary on YouTube a while back. It's called The Bitter Truth About Sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it's a doctor. He describes how the sweetener used in all this pop, high fructose corn syrup, actually forces your liver to create fat.
Mm-hmm.
He deals with six-month-old babies that are overweight. And you look at the baby formula, and guess what's inside of it? The same stuff that's in pop.
Well, you have a good point, Dennis. In fact, any sugars, excess sugar, will do that because it's not just the high fructose corn syrup. It follows, the liver follows, you know, liver will process sugar because high fructose corn syrup is simply fructose.
And it will not process sugar.
Of course it will.
No.
Sugar, Dennis, sugar is a...
Pancreas does.
Dennis, sugar is... Sucrose is a combination of glucose and fructose. That's what sucrose is. Your body cleaves that in two, so you end up with glucose and fructose. Your liver will process those exactly the same thing as the fructose in the corn syrup. The difference is the concentration of them. Your pancreas responds to sugar levels as it would with any kind of sugar, and it'll produce insulin to deal with the sugar load. So basic chemistry and the basic biochemistry and glucose cycle that the body uses doesn't really care whether it's fructose or glucose. In fact, when you look at the pattern at which the biochemical pathway that the body uses to break down sugar, it goes from glucose to fructose down the line. So it's really just where it is in that chain of breaking things down. So
that's what I thought too. And I watched this video, and this guy actually shows how your various organs process sugar versus fructose.
Yes, well, with
the fructose, the regular fructose that comes from fruit, that's one thing. The powdered variety is different.
I really have my doubts about that because talking.
If you ever have the time, watch the video.
It is
scary.
It is a YouTube video without any evidence to support it.
It's somebody who videotaped the guy. And this guy is a well-known doctor.
Well,
he's giving a presentation. That's all it is.
Well, that's fine. He can give a presentation, but a YouTube video doesn't constitute publishing something about it. It's simply a YouTube video. The issue is that what you are saying is that the fructose is a different chemical compound in one product versus another. But fructose is fructose. The amount that's being given, and if you're giving a lot more, yes, you may have differences in how the liver will process it only because of the amount that's being given in the food that's being consumed. But the biochemical pathways that use this and break it down are the same biochemical pathways, regardless of whether it's coming from corn
or
whether
it's different.
If it's different, then it wouldn't be called fructose.
I'm telling you, after seeing this presentation, it basically says 100 calories of sugar versus 100 calories of high fructose corn syrup. The corn syrup stuff will force your liver to create the fat versus sugar. Well, it might or might not.
Well, you know, what I can say is that I cannot make a conclusion based on a YouTube video. That's not the way science is done. Science is done on the basis of publishing things. So
it's just I'm telling you, if you see this video, this is not something where two people sit in the room. This is a guy going in presentation
in front
of a bunch of people.
And I hear you. And lots of people give presentations at conferences, but it doesn't necessarily mean that what they're presenting is actually correct. It's just a presentation. When in the process of giving a presentation, they have to have data to support it. And that's where when I look up information, I want to see where it's coming from. Someone that's presenting something to me, and even things that I say on the air, I want people to challenge me. I don't want people to take my word for it because I have to have evidence when I'm saying something. I can't just say something and say that this is the way it is. And I encourage people to challenge things, and I welcome it. And so when I look up stuff and I want to have multiple sources to show me where this is coming from. And so a video in and of itself is not the forum per se. And sure, it's a conference and you may have presented something, but it's one video of one presentation that may not necessarily reflect the body of information associated with that particular topic.
All right.
Well, thanks for calling, Dennis. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the number to call. And we're going to line one, and good afternoon to Carlo and Elmer.
Good afternoon,
Hi.
Doc. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm 72 years old, and I'm always monitoring my blood pressure basically every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I have discovered a couple of weeks ago that my heart skips a beat from time to time,
mm-hmm.
which didn't happen before.
Right.
And what happened is a couple of weeks ago, I went to a family reunion and all excitement and everything, and my blood pressure went up to 180, and which is not normal for me because I take something to control my blood pressure.
It's pretty high.
Yeah. And when I got home, well, I was dizzy.
Mm-hmm.
Head was spinning. When I got home, I took an aspirin, went to bed, and the next morning, I felt very, very tired. And still I didn't feel right. I wasn't walking right. And the whole day, I basically stayed in bed. And then the third day, I started to get better and got better, better, and better. But now I notice that my heart is missing a beat from time to time.
Well, there's two issues. One is your blood pressure. The other is a skipped beat. Skipped beats are actually fairly common. And we usually don't do too much about that under circumstances where someone is functioning reasonably well. That is, they don't feel faint. They're not collapsing. The other issue is when there is an irregular heartbeat, you want to know how long it goes on for, how fast the heart is beating when that's happening. And so usually when we're looking at arrhythmias or changes in heart rate, you're looking at situations where the heart starts to beat very quickly. Under most circumstances, you tend to see the heart rate go up to 140, 150, 160, and without any, you know, this person's not exercising, and it's just very, very fast, and a person can feel really off or faint. So a skip beat, and all of us get skip beats from time to time. So a skip beat every so often usually doesn't reflect any specific health problem.
But I have a very low heartbeat.
What is your normal heart rate?
Well, in the morning it would be about 50.
Mm-hmm.
I go for my walk. When I come back from my walk, which I walk about a mile per day,
right,
is up to 80.
Okay, and so that's okay. I mean, 50 is a little lowish, but again, there are people that who are in good shape whose heart rates will be low, and very common to see that. And again, it's only an issue, especially if it's around 50 to 80, it's only an issue if a person is having symptoms. And the most common symptoms, especially for low heart rates, is a drop in blood pressure, feeling faint, collapsing, falling, those kind of signs that you see with low heart rates. But a blood pressure that's going up to 180 that you experienced, I would probably want to see how well your blood pressure did over a period. So there are ways to find out whether the blood pressure is normal most of the time. One of them is doing what's known as an ambulatory blood pressure, where there's a monitor that's used for 24 hours to evaluate what your pressure is doing when you're sleeping, when you're out and about, and when you're doing your exercise or going for a walk, to see if this is really well controlled. And if it is, then it's less of an issue. I mean, the 180, I'd still want to know why that happened. When this happened, were you dancing? What was going on? Like,
what happened is that it was a family reunion, and
yeah.
I have a big family. There were a lot of children.
Right.
And what happened, one of my great-grandchildren fell from the stairs and it dislocated his shoulder.
Okay.
And right away I felt, oh my gosh, this is bad. I can't stand this and that, you know?
All right. So that makes a lot more sense. So anybody's blood pressure will go up when they get anxious or they're facing a, a situation that has scared them or has affected them, and that's seeing a child hurt themselves is going to be quite a provoking type of event. And so blood pressure will go up, and it would be expected to go up. The issue is whether your pressure is normal on situations where that isn't a factor. And if your pressure is relatively normal throughout that time, then I would say you had a normal physiological reaction to a very stressful event. Blood pressure will always go up when a person is stressed, but it's how you recovered. And if your pressure now is normal, and under most of the day it is a normal blood pressure, then it's not an area where I would be overly concerned. If it was 180 and you were just talking to me now and it was 180, I'd say, yes, there's something that's going on that needs to be looked at.
So it, could it be that that condition that I had 2 weeks ago would create my heart to miss a beat from time to time?
It might be, but I don't necessarily think so. I think sometimes we pay attention to things more when, especially since you had the initial condition, it's made you more aware of your heartbeat and your blood pressure. And so we tend to be a little bit more vigilant about it. And so we may feel things more or notice things more only because we've been made more aware of it. But what I would say is that if you really have some concerns about the heart rate, be good to see your physician. They can also do what's known as a Holter monitor, which will check and see what your heart is doing throughout the course of 24 hours to see if this heart rate or the extra beats are there.
Thank you, doctor.
You're very welcome. All the best. And we'll take a break for the news. Back in a few minutes. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Speak to you soon.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Back to the phone lines. Good afternoon to Jacques in Gatineau.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Yes, my name is Jacques.
Yes.
I was wondering, somebody I know coughed up blood clots,
mm-hmm.
the loony size, three of them actually, and I was wondering what was the cause, what could be the cause.
So was this something that happened to you?
No, somebody I know.
Okay, and so this was just coughing and the blood came up when they were coughing?
Blood clots, loony size.
Okay. Anybody that coughs up blood, especially if it's from the lung, is obviously not a normal thing.
Of course.
And so the most common things you have to be concerned about when there is, if we are assuming that it is blood from the lung, are usually growths or infection in the lung itself.
Oh, okay.
So does this person smoke? Are they a smoker?
No. I think it was caused by radiation to the lung.
Right. So you have damage to the lung or inflammation to the
lung.
Exactly. And so the tissue will bleed. And because it bleeds, it goes into the airway. It'll collect a little bit.
Right.
And then the lung tries to expel it. And so it's coughed up. But yeah, it's definitely not a normal thing to have blood come up. And as you've very importantly mentioned, that in this case, if this person had radiation to the chest,
exactly.
then it is going to cause damage to the tissues in that area, which will then sometimes break down and bleed, which can lead to the coughing up of the blood.
Oh, I see. So is this like infectious? Is it, can it like worsen? Can it, what would be the result of the radiation and all that stuff?
Well, now this was radiation to treat what condition?
Oh, cancer.
It is. And it was lung cancer, I would imagine.
It was like near. So it just affected the lung a little bit.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, usually, again, radiation damage has to be determined on the basis of how long the exposure was, the intensity or the dosing of the radiation, how strong it was, and how frequent they had the radiation. So those are all factors.
Oh,
usually, though, tissue will heal over time.
Right.
But it certainly indicates that whatever treatment they're having is having a toll on their body. I mean, as much as they're trying to fight the cancer, there are side effects from the radiation. It's not an infection. If it was the radiation, it's actual tissue damage. It's really no different than, you know, if you scraped your arm and you had some bleeding on your arm from damage. Right. It's the same thing, except on the inside where the tissue has been, for lack of a better word, burned by the radiation.
So it should heal by itself.
Normally it will heal. It's something that should be reported to the physicians who are looking after this person so that they know what's happened. Right. They may want to evaluate the lung to see exactly the extent of the damage.
Right.
They may want to do an X-ray of the lung to look and see if there's any fluid in there.
Okay.
So it's something that they should report. They shouldn't just leave it alone and say, oh, you know, well, let's see what happens later on. Given that the person has received radiation, they should let their physicians, their oncologists know what happened so they can do the appropriate evaluation and follow-up.
Exactly. And which would explain why he's coughing all the time on a regular basis.
It certainly can, especially if there's irritation to the lung. That's why to reduce the level of suffering, I think this should be reported because there are things that can be done to help with the cough as well.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Jacques.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And over to line two, and Joyce in Ottawa. Good afternoon. Hello, Joyce.
Oh, yes.
Hi.
Dr. Rorkin. I just had an abdominal and pelvic ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
And the results came back with some fluid in the endometrium.
Mm-hmm.
And they want me to have an ultrasound another in 3 months.
Okay.
And I was diagnosed with breast cancer 3 years ago, and they put me on tamoxifen.
Okay.
And I just wondered what you think about that.
Well, fluid in the endometrium doesn't imply any masses. It simply means that they found some fluid inside. The endometrium is the tissue that lines the inside of the uterus. Endo meaning inside, metrium refers to the muscle layer, and it's just the tissue that it's a tissue that bleeds because of a period or menstrual cycles. That's where the bleeding comes from.
Mm-hmm.
So fluid in and of itself doesn't represent too much. It can be from inflammation. It can be after a period. It can be from medications. Anything can do that. What we're more concerned about when an ultrasound is done is whether there are masses, whether there's thickening of the layer of the endometrium, an enlarged uterus. Those type of measurements have a lot more import than the fluid itself, because the fluid is very nonspecific. It can be also just part of a normal physiology. There can be fluid that accumulates and then disappears over time. So in and of itself, if they haven't mentioned any cysts, any masses, any thickness of the endometrium or that tissue layer, then following up in 3 months is just fine, because there really is no indication of any specific disease that's going on, just on the basis of that fluid being there.
Well, now will that go away though eventually, or
usually fluid is absorbed, but at the same time, again, the most important thing is whether there are any tissue changes, because the fluid in itself doesn't necessarily reflect changes to the tissue. The tissue is secretory, so it will produce fluid in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the absence of infections, of fever, of discharge, of anything that could be necessarily reflective of infection or inflammation or growths, if nothing like that is there that was found on ultrasound, then you're pretty much safe to wait the 3 months to see how things go and to do another measurement with the ultrasound.
So the tamoxifen wouldn't have any effect on that at all?
Well, tamoxifen is more of an anti-estrogen. It blocks the effect of the estrogen.
Yeah.
So what you would normally expect is an endometrial lining that's very thin. So in effect, it would prevent growth of the endometrium. It would prevent the effect of estrogen on the endometrium so that it wouldn't get very thick or bleed very much.
Mm-hmm.
So in and of itself, that would be more protective than harmful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Joyce.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And we're going to go to line four and Nancy in Ottawa. Good afternoon. Hello, Nancy.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, doctor. I'm calling about weight loss.
Yes.
I have lost about 95 pounds in a year. In the last 6 months, I've gained 40 of it back.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no problem losing. I have no problem gaining. Unfortunately, it was easier gaining. But I'm on the road again of losing. Again, I have about 95 pounds more to go.
So what did you do to lose that 95 pounds?
I stayed off all carbs.
So you reduced your calorie intake?
Majorly.
Right.
Yes. And what did it quite easily, quite effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But my question for you today, I guess, is I don't want to lose the next 95 and have it come back again.
Mm-hmm.
So what other than losing weight do I have to do or should try to look at doing in order to change my mindset, my whatever, to keep it off this time when I do lose the last 95 pounds?
Well, I will paraphrase what Dr. Yoni Friedhoff advises, because he's very much on the ball with regards to weight loss and trying to maintain that weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
The main question that people have to ask themselves is, can I continue to do this for the rest of my life?
Right.
And am I enjoying what I'm doing? Mm-hmm. That is, can I actually live with this and enjoy doing that? So mm-hmm. the issue is, if you are carbohydrate restricting to the point of saying, you know, I'm really getting tired of carbohydrate restricting, then that is not the diet to be on, because that leads to exactly what you've described is sort of a yo-yo diet,
mm-hmm.
where you restrict and it works for a while,
mm-hmm.
but then the restrictions go away,
mm-hmm.
and there's a resumption of standard eating patterns, and you gain the weight back.
Right.
So you may want to look at means of losing weight more slowly, but in so doing, enjoying the food that you're eating and not feeling like you are restricting or depriving yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So you may not lose it as fast, but you may completely prevent the yo-yo dieting because you're doing something that you enjoy. That is, mm-hmm. you're not feeling like you have to all of a sudden switch gears again and go back to a pattern to lose more weight.
Not feeling like I'm depriving myself.
That's exactly it. Because if you manage to lose 95 pounds in a year, that's really quite severe restriction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of calories to restrict.
Yeah.
So if you found that doing that was manageable, then you certainly will find it manageable to moderate that restriction so that you combine mm-hmm. sort of the restriction that you have, but mm-hmm. not to the point where you're saying, man, I'm getting fed up of this,
right.
and still being able to continue to lose weight. Ideally, we like to see people lose on the average of maybe, because it becomes sustainable that way, 1 to 2 pounds a month. So you were losing almost 8 pounds a month.
Yeah.
And so that's a lot of restriction. 8 pounds mm-hmm. is 28,000 calories of restriction. So mm-hmm. you are literally reducing your calorie intake by 1,000 calories a day.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of calories to restrict. So if you were, I would recommend that you actually see a dietitian,
mm-hmm.
and they will be able to develop on the basis of what you like to eat mm-hmm. and what you're willing to restrict, develop a plan for you that will be something that you can follow over the rest of your life that you feel comfortable doing that will contribute to an ongoing weight loss and then stabilization. So having that little bit of support you might find very helpful. And so there are a lot of registered dietitians out there who would be more than helpful for you to do that.
Right. I was able to go off all my insulin.
I know. It's fantastic when you lose that weight.
It was, and I was walking with a walker. Now I can walk anywhere.
That's absolutely fantastic,
Nancy.
Life. Yeah, and so, I think you have, look at it this way, you're still 55 pounds down.
Yeah.
So you're still at a nice negative balance with regards to the weight loss.
Yeah.
And I really think it just needs some tweaking so that you mm-hmm. don't feel deprived. And it's so important when people change their diet to the point where they just get fed up. That's mm-hmm. not it should not even be called a diet. There's really, you shouldn't be on a diet. You should have a change in how your eating patterns and the foods that you consume mm-hmm. so that overall you gradually lose the weight mm-hmm. and don't feel like you're actually working to lose that weight.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Nancy. And keep at it, because that, it's fantastic that you did that. I just think it needs some tweaking so that you can continue to do that and avoid that yo-yo dieting.
I have my diabetic nurse on Thursday.
That's perfect.
So that's where we'll aim.
Excellent.
Thank you so much,
All the best to you.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And we'll take a small break. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Is there a way to find a cure for this and plant it in a pill?
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
I don't want to be the crutch, one step away.
And back to the phone lines, and a good afternoon to Peggy in Ottawa.
Oh, hi. Dr. Dworkin. I have a question for you.
Sure.
I get a lot of heart palpitations. Can that be connected with my thyroid?
It can be. If the thyroid, you tend to see heart palpitations in people who have hyperthyroidism, where they have too much thyroid hormone being produced and the heart rate will go up and you can have these palpitations.
Okay, if anything, it would be hypo as opposed to hyper.
So less likely to get palpitations then because of that. The other issue is how often the palpitations occur.
Probably 10 or 12 times a day.
Okay, and how?
No reason.
Okay, and how long do they last when it happens?
Probably 30 to 40 seconds, maybe.
Okay, so if it's happening 12 times a day, 30 to 40 seconds, the best way, and do you monitor how fast the heart is beating when that's going on?
No, all I know is that like it beats so quickly that it's up on my very upper chest below my neck, let's say.
So given that the extent that you're finding it's going very fast and it's happening often, you would probably want to see your physician to have an evaluation done to determine if this represents an abnormal heart rhythm or an arrhythmia. And the way that's usually done is a test that's called, it's a monitoring test called a Holter monitor. And it simply monitors your heartbeat over 24 hours.
Right.
There's a button that you will press. It's a digital recorder. There's a button you press when the palpitations occur so that they can zero in on exactly those times that it's happening. They can look at the way the heart has been beating. And on the basis of that heart rhythm that they see, they can, most of the time, diagnose exactly what the arrhythmia is, if it is an arrhythmia. And on the basis of that, the next step would be to see a cardiologist who will then propose various treatments to prevent that rhythm disturbance from becoming any worse and also to control it. So there is a stepwise process, but if this is, again, happening 12 times a day and the heart rate is going very fast and you feel it in your chest, then this definitely is something that needs to be evaluated and not just it's not just a wait and see what happens scenario.
Yeah, so what you're saying is it could be dangerous.
Certain heart arrhythmias can be dangerous. That's exactly right. The most common thing that you'll see with a heart arrhythmia is people can faint sometimes because their blood pressures can drop.
Yeah, and I feel like tingling or numbness in my arms when this happens.
Yeah, so there's
in both my arms.
Yeah, so there's something odd that's going on. And again, the other issue with arrhythmias is that the arrhythmia can become even more severe and you end up with a heart that's just not pumping properly at all, which is obviously not very good.
Right.
So I would get this. Your family doctor can certainly order the Holter monitor, and there are several centers around town that will do that. And very quickly, it can be found out exactly what's going on. Especially if this is going on every day. That's the key thing. If this is happening every day, then definitely the heart rate.
And I got to say that, you know, when it first began, I didn't think of it anything more than, oh, a fluttery heart.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been increasingly longer and increasingly more often. And I guess that's why, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that want to be, you want to make sure that it you know, make sure about whether this is atrial fibrillation, which is can be relatively dangerous if it's atrial fibrillation. You know, whether this represents an arrhythmia of another part of the heart, whether it's another area of the heart where there's where the electrical pulses normally will make the heart beat normally. There can be detours in those in the wiring and cause the heart to beat more quickly. So there, it's not something that, again, you should really sit around on. It does require, I would say, more of an urgent evaluation just because we don't know what we're dealing with.
Okay.
And because we don't know what we're dealing with, there's really no way to know how to treat it. So you have to diagnose what this is.
Right. And what if it is that? What do they do to treat it?
Well, there's many approaches, right? Because each arrhythmia has a different approach. So a lot of times it's taking medications that actually slow down those electrical pulses and prevent the arrhythmia. There's
okay.
other treatments involve what's called ablation, where they'll go through the artery with a small scope and they'll find the area of the heart that has those nerve cells or the bundle of cells that are responsible for producing that electrical pulse, and they'll burn that and ablate it so that it doesn't do that anymore to allow the heart to beat normally again.
Right.
Other people need pacemakers. So there's a whole slew of options to treat, and it really is wholly dependent on the type of arrhythmia that there is. So there's no one treatment right now that I'd say is going to work. We
right.
don't have a diagnosis
those,
yet.
Those are roughly
yeah.
what would happen.
Yeah, but there are many approaches,
yeah.
and most arrhythmias are very well controlled. There are specific treatments for that really control things and just get rid of it altogether.
Perfect.
All right.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome, Peggy.
Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
And very quickly, we're going to go to our last caller, Madeline in Woodlawn. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, it's Madeline.
Hi.
Oh, Dr. Dworkin, I'm so glad to get you. Anyway, I have COPD.
Yes.
And I have an oxygen concentrator.
Mm-hmm.
I do not qualify for oxygen in my last pulmonary test.
Okay.
I don't qualify, sort of what, you know, qualify.
Okay.
But I use it because it gives me relief sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Am I okay doing that?
Now this,
I have looked on the internet and
yeah.
some things say the dangers. I don't even know what the dangers are, but...
Well,
is it okay for me to do that?
Well,
if I feel better.
Was this prescribed for you?
No.
It
no.
wasn't. Okay.
No, I have a concentrator that I got.
So is this hooked up to an oxygen tank?
No, no, no. It's one of those concentrators where it takes it from the air.
Okay. Well, you have to be careful if you get too much oxygen because with COPD,
yeah.
what happens is that you're it's a rather complex way that your body tries to keep you breathing. And
okay.
so if you take in too much concentration of oxygen, you actually may reduce your body's ability to actually know when it has to take its next breath. And so that's part of the problem. Ideally,
okay.
for COPD, you have to treat COPD very aggressively. It involves exercise and
yes.
also certain medications.
Yes, I do.
And there are some newer medications out to treat COPD that may help you feel that the breathing is a bit easier.
I do Simicor.
Yeah.
And Spiriva.
Yeah, and there is another new one that is out called Draxas that also helps. I think it's Draxas.
Okay.
That you may want to speak to your physician about.
I'll look it up.
But
yeah.
I would be careful about taking any extra oxygen if there's no specific indication for it, because that can be harmful to you.
Oh, I didn't know that it could harm you. Yeah. I, you know, that was my fear.
Well, I would speak to your doctor, Madeline, and hopefully they'll find another solution for you that will work well.
Draxas. D-R-A-X-A-S?
That's right.
Thank you so much.
All the best, Madeline.
Okay, thank
okay.
you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
My thanks to Sebastian for producing Sunday House Call. My thanks to everyone who has called in today. We will be back next week with another edition of Sunday House Call. You've been listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.